Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum present. As we always do before we get to our agenda, wow, I don't have my voice yet today. Everyone here must be seated when they are in the hearing room. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. If you need accommodation, please let staff know. Signs aren't permitted in the hearing room or the testifiers table. Commissioners, I'm looking at you. No, you're here today. No signs. clapping and other disruptions aren't allowed, and testifiers have been given time limits. If somebody decides to testify, we'll be providing you with a time limit just so that we can get through the bill and all the amendments and have full discussion on our bill today. The first order of business is approval of the meeting minutes from April 4th, 2024. Vice Chair Feist, would you move to approve those minutes?
Yes, so moved, Madam Chair.
All those in favor of the minutes for April 4th, 2024, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. And the first and only bill on today's agenda is House File 5216. This is the public safety budget bill. Because it is my bill, I will move that House File 5216 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And I will also move the DE1 amendment, but we do have amendments to that. So right now we'll just move the DE1 amendment. And I will ask our staff to walk through the bill, and then I'll make a few additional comments as well. Let's start with the spreadsheet, Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair and members, you should have a one-page spreadsheet in your packets, and I guess I'll just start from the top. We have the Department of Public Safety on line 5. There is an increase to the appropriation for crime victim services of $9,557,000. This is a one-time appropriation. On line 6, $100,000 one-time is included for House File 4215. This is for therapy dogs for first responders. On line 7, House File 4387, a task force for domestic violence and firearms was provided $50,000. On line 8, House File 1832, a task force on traffic stops, $133,000 was included for that. And on line 9, the telecommunicator certification and training, $1.45 million with $1 million a year ongoing beginning in fiscal year 2026. This is money from the E911 fund. That would, and on line 18, the total all funds for public safety is $11,290,000 in this biennium and $2 million in TAILS. Moving down to line 21, the Department of Corrections. On line 26, we have an operating adjustment. This is for a deficiency and some ongoing salary needs. $5.9 million in fiscal year 24, $2 million in fiscal year 25, and the TAILS are $7,091,000 per year beginning in fiscal year 2026. On line 35, we have the Clemency Review Commission. This is to move the Clemency Review Commission out of the Department of Corrections and have it be its own unique entity. They are taking $986,000 with them from the department's budget, and you can see on line 51 a corresponding cancellation in the Department of Corrections from last year's bill. On line 43, we have other agencies. There's an appropriation to MMB, Office of Addiction and Recovery. This is for a task force, and that is $150,000 one time in fiscal year 2025. And on line 55, these are bills that are traveling separately from this legislation. House File 4300, Safe Storage of Firearms, there's $10,000 in fiscal year 2025 and $19,000 per year in TAILS. Madam Chair, below that are just fund totals for the bill and a reconciliation against the committee's target, and there are no dollars left on the bottom line, and with that, I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Walls. And we will move now to Mr. Johnson to walk through the bill for us. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, members, Ben Johnson from House Research. I'm going to walk through the provisions of the bill at a fairly high level. Most of Article 1 reflects the spreadsheet that Mr. Walls walked through. So if you're looking at the bill, you can go to page 5 on line 23. There is a provision titled Fire Marshal. This is a conforming change to a 2023 appropriation that allows the use of an appropriation to the Fire Marshal for urban search and rescue and the air rescue team. We're going to move to Article 2. That starts at the bottom of page 8. Section 8 is from Representative Frazier's House File 1832. This requires peace officers making a traffic stop for violations of Chapter 168 or 169 to state the reasons for the stop. The following sections 2, 3, and 4 are all from the underlying House File 5216. These are changes requested by the Department of Public Safety. Section 2 amends the definition of state emergency response asset to apply to teams that have entered into contractual agreements with the State Fire Marshal Division. Section 3 amends the definition of urban search and rescue. And Section 4 authorizes the Commissioner of Public Safety to retain up to 10% of the appropriation for grants and aid to the Youth Intervention Program. Currently, only 2% may be retained. That takes us to Section 5. That's on page 9, beginning at line 21. This is also from Representative Frazier's House File 1832. Creates a task force to examine issues related to motor vehicle registration and registration tax compliance. Section 6, which is on page 11 at line 26, is from Representative Pinto's House File 4959. This is the task force on holistic and effective responses to illicit drug use. Section 7, which is page 14 starting at line 2, is another Representative Pinto bill. This is House File 4387. This creates the task force on domestic violence and firearm surrender. That takes us to Article 3. Article 3 begins at the top of page 16. Section 1 is Representative Becker Finn's House File 4244. This moves the deposit of 25% of the earned incentive release savings from the general fund to crime victim services. With that change, 50% of the savings go to crime victim services. The rest of that article, sections 2 through 5, are from the underlying House File 5216. These are requests from the Department of Corrections. Section 2 and 3 remove a reference to a section that was repealed last session. Section 4 terminates the assistance provided by the department to the Clemency Review Commission. This is consistent with establishing that commission as an independent entity. Section 5 extends the period of time in which the Department of Corrections will provide the Cannabis Expungement Board with support. That takes us to Article 4. Article 4 is on page 18, starting at line 4. This is the remainder of the DE amendment. This article is Representative Wolgamott's House File 3966, creating a board to oversee public safety telecommunicator training and certification. Madam Chair, that completes the high-level walkthrough. I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And I'll just make a few comments about the bill, too, before we get to our testifiers and then the amendments. There's a big chunk of the money that we were allocated for the DOC deficiency funding, the operations adjustments, and I know the commissioner will be speaking to that. But essentially, then, what we were left with for this year was approximately $10 million that didn't have tails. And so we put a substantial amount of that, $9.5 million, into victim services funding. I know we heard that bill early on in session, and I anticipate some testimony about that today and the importance of making sure that we're funding our victim services programs throughout the state. And those are advocates that work with victim survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, general crime, and children. The situation is even more dire now than when we first heard the bill. The federal funding, it's a much larger cut than we were even anticipating before. So it's about a 40% cut to the state from that. And this is happening nationwide. It's not specific to Minnesota, but it is a very large cut. And so even what we're putting in here is not going to be enough. This is just a Band-Aid, really, to get us through to the next cycle. And we need to think more long term about how we fund these really important programs. They are absolutely essential to Minnesota. This bill does have have a provision related to any savings we get in the future through MRRA, diverting more funds than to victim programming. That is one way that we can perhaps have some more sustainable funding for these programs. But clearly more needs to be done. And I think if you take a look at the letter that's in the packet from the coalitions, and I think it's really telling all of the different organizations and individuals that have signed up in support of funding for victim services. You've got police chiefs, sheriffs, county attorneys, social workers, probation officers. I saw some mayors on the list, nonprofits, of course, all of the programs that are impacted by these programs, even some in the business community. And these are entities that are throughout our entire state. It's not specific to any one county, one city, one jurisdiction. It's impacting us statewide, and it impacts our public safety. If we don't have the appropriate services for victims, survivors of crime, then it has a negative impact on how we're keeping the citizens of the state safe. So that is, I just wanted to let people know that that's why we invested such a large amount of the $10 million that we were allocated to victim services. We also have a grant there for the therapy dogs. That's a Representative Mueller bill, and I think really important that we address first responder mental health issues. I do know that the tax bill that has the $300 million in public safety aid, I've seen some preliminary list of how that money has been spent. It's been spent on a lot of different things, but I know that mental health services for first responders is something that local communities are deciding to spend that money on as well. So I think that is important. I would like to do more, and we'll continue to have that discussion in future years, I'm sure, as well. And then I'd say the rest of the money that we're spent really is on a variety of different task forces or working groups, and that's really to set us up for the budget year next year. Some of these things require a lot of stakeholder engagement that we just don't have the capacity to do when we're have such short timelines during session. And so some of these things really are going to try to get those stakeholders all together in the interim to come back with some recommendations. Those items include the task force on the motor vehicle registration and what we do if we decide not to criminalize people who don't pay their tabs. We want to make sure that revenue is still being collected. And it's actually a very complicated issue. It's not just something that the bill author or I could get the stakeholders together to address. This affects deputy registrars. That money that is coming in is spent on very important things. So we need to think creatively about other ways that we can make sure that we're still capturing that revenue, with also not having police stop people for failure to pay their taxes. I think there's some agreement that we, at least when we had this discussion in past years, from both sides of the aisle, that was something that we wanted to look into and perhaps do something about. So that task force will really set us up for future discussion. And then the task force on domestic violence and firearms. We know that when law enforcement and other first responders respond to a call for domestic violence, those can be very dangerous and sadly can be deadly, as we experienced this year in Burnsville. And so we, Chair Pinto and I, have been talking about the issue of firearms in the hands of abusers for a number of years. It's a complicated issue, and we really want to have some work done in the interim to look at how we can best make sure that those abusers that shouldn't have guns don't have guns. And then the other task force is related to the holistic and effective responses to illicit drug use. Really, the problems that we're seeing in Minnesota related to substance use disorder and overdoses, we should be responding to drug cases as they are a health crisis. And so the work that we started last year with the research project, this is a continuation of that work again, because there are many stakeholders that need to be involved in that discussion. And so we want to have some good ideas and recommendations coming forward from that working group. And then the other thing I'll just point to that's outside of the general fund budget, it's the 911 telecommuter training and standards boards. The Representative Volkamot bill and Representative Igo presented that as well. And I know that was something that is, again, really important to both sides of the aisle. And that comes out of a separate revenue account We heard some great testimony about that, so that's included in this bill as well. And so before we get into member discussion, we will sign up for testimony. I know that we have Commissioner Schnell and Commissioner Jacobson both here to testify, so I don't if you want to come down. I couldn't see back there. Come on forward.
Chair Mueller.
Oh, yep, Representative Novotny.
If I could just not to take away anything from the Burnsville tragedy, but also recognize that Deputy Owens of Pope County also was at a domestic arrest situation when he gave up his life.
Thank you for that. Commissioner Schnell, are you going first?
Yes.
All right, please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. My name is Paul Schnell. I am the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Corrections. I first want to say thank you for the opportunity to testify on the language of the Delete All Amendment to House File 5216. And I want to start by offering a wholehearted thank you for funding the DOC's operating adjustment. I'll state the obvious, it's a significant number. The DOC is almost entirely reliant on the general fund, and the agency is heavily impacted by a wide range of cost pressures. This year, the department's supplemental budget request is the result of a negotiated compensation increase that makes the DOC's pay competitive with county jails and the Federal Bureau of Prisons. These compensation increases have changed the landscape for the department. Instead of facing a staffing crisis, forced overtime, routine facility lockdowns, and significant staff burnout, we are now able to report that the DOC is expected to be at 97% complement across facilities by the end of May. Your bill is an investment in the well-being of over 4,000 state employees who work within our state prison. It is an investment in stabilizing our workforce so those who are incarcerated are not subject to rolling lockdowns and have regular access to transformational rehabilitative programming. It is an investment in strengthening the mission of the Department of Correction to transform the lives for a safer Minnesota. And I would be remiss if I didn't speak to the conversation about the investment in victim services. I spent this morning meeting with the families of people who lost family members to homicide as part of the parole hearing process. It's not lost on me that we spend and invest dollars rightly in providing the opportunities for people to access transformational services that's good and right for the safety of Minnesota. But it's also striking that in these meetings today, many times, the first time these families have had an opportunity and been asked to come in and speak to their loss for the first time in 27 years since that sentencing. And many of them speak to that loss as though they are standing on the steps of the courthouse 27 years ago. And so I think it is incredible and important that the investment that the committee is making in victim services, and I'm really pleased to see the additional investment, the policy investment in using that 25% go to MRA investment as the dividend of reinvestment coming from the transformational opportunities that we provide those who are incarcerated. Again, I want to just thank you for your leadership in supporting the Department of Corrections, its staff, and the work they do and is greatly appreciated. And I can't thank you enough for the work you all do in supporting both our agency and the people of Minnesota. There is also a letter of support for the bill in the materials included. And with that, members, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have after my esteemed colleague makes his comments.
Thank you. Commissioner Jacobson, welcome back. Please introduce yourself and begin.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Chair Mueller, members of the House Public Safety Committee. I am Bob Jacobson, Commissioner of Public Safety, and it's my honor to serve in that capacity. I have provided some written testimony, so my remarks will be brief today. I do want to first start by thanking you for this bill. Last year's public safety bill was historic, and this bill will build on that and make a big difference for the state of Minnesota. This bill includes three items put forward in the Governor and Lieutenant Governor's supplemental budget bill, which will help DPS continue to grow on the important work that we do. The nearly $10 million in crime victim services funding shows that Minnesota is willing not only to step up when the federal government funding slows down, but to go above and beyond that for crime victim services. The update to the non-responsible party fund allows for additional state teams like Urban Search and Rescue and Minnesota Air Rescue to tap into resources to get reimbursed. These teams are made up mostly of local agencies who go outside of their geographic boundaries to help other Minnesotans. You all provided the funding last year. We should make sure that these teams can also get reimbursed. Also, the update to the YUP administrative funding is critically important. We have, as you know, gone through OLA audits on grant programs and have heard from the OLA and legislators that we need to make sure that grants are properly administered. This change will move the YIP grant to the state standard, and this will also be important when YIP moves to the new state agency. In closing, I just want to add, as you probably are well aware, that it is Public Safety Telecommunicators Week this week. I want to thank all the telecommunicators in Minnesota who are a critical part of the public safety landscape. And lastly, I want to thank you, Chair Mueller, and the committee members and hardworking staff. The work that you do is important to public safety in the state of Minnesota. We appreciate it. Myself and DPS staff are here to answer any questions as you have. Thank you.
Thank you. And normally we get through all the testimony, but since you're both there, maybe we can pause right now and see if members have any questions for either of you. Lead Nabotny.
I will eventually have some questions for Commissioner Jacobson about one of my amendments. Would you like me to address that now?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that now, because I don't typically take testimony on the amendments. So let's go ahead and ask those now.
Commissioner Jacobson, we've got a couple of amendments that I'll be addressing. There's two different provisions of this omnibus bill that regard traffic stops. And one of the programs that has been very impactful in the state in reducing drunk driving or impaired driving overall is a program called Safe and Sober. They still call it Safe and Sober?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Novotny. It's towards zero deaths.
Okay.
Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. And Commissioner Jacobson, when I was participating in those programs, you were encouraged to stop as many cars as possible, make those contacts. Many of the contacts, a good majority of the contacts, were just good public relations contacts. Hey, your headlight's out. Hey, your taillight's out. Somebody's coming home from work. Somebody's coming home from church. You'd make that contact, you'd let them know, and you'd be on your way. But you also had contacts with people that maybe didn't have a chance to observe impairment because you'd had to follow them for a period of time to see some signs of impairment. But during your course of contact with them, you would discover odor of an alcoholic beverage, bloodshot, watery eyes, all the indications that it would include impairment. Are we still funding those programs? Will we continue to fund those programs, a lot of them federally administered, that encourage high contact stops?
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee, Representative Otney. Thank you for the question. Just in listening to the opening today, there are a number of areas in public safety where we need to pay attention to and where funding needs are. We have a lot of committees and task forces. What it shows me again today is that the need is great throughout public safety for funding and assistance to do our work. One of the things that I will say when it comes to traffic safety, one of our deep concerns this year, especially being part of leading the Minnesota State Patrol or overseeing that function, our traffic fatalities are up significantly this year. They are at 86 currently this year, traffic fatalities compared to 55 one year ago today. The factors involved in that may be complicated. I don't know exactly what's driving that. Some suspicion is that we had a very mild winter, and so that driving habits became more like summer when fatalities do sometimes go up. But you know, that's not yet to be fully determined. A lot of those causes of fatalities, as you know, are caused by inattentive driving, by speed, and also by driving while under the influence, whether it be alcohol or a combination of other factors. We are certainly seeing a concern with people who are driving more often with a multiple number of chemicals in their system. It's not just alcohol anymore. It may be alcohol and some other combination of one or two other substances. So we have a great deal of concern for traffic safety for the motoring public. We think that it's important to make sure that we give our police officers, our troopers, and our sheriff's deputies all around the state of Minnesota ample opportunity to make those traffic stops, to look for impaired driving, and also just to make sure that our roadways are continue to be safe. I couldn't tell you right now what the exact funding levels are for TCD going into this next fiscal year. But again, I know that the needs are great in several areas, but I know any funding certainly would be appreciated by law enforcement. Last thing I'll add is that we just also had our first tribal traffic safety summit, first one in many years, put on not only with DPS, but with MnDOT and Minnesota Department of Health. So we met with our tribal partners and law enforcement from in and around our tribal communities. Traffic safety is also a huge concern for our tribal partners. And as they have mentioned also, there are high disparities in the number of tribal members who are hurt, injured, or killed in traffic crashes around the state of Minnesota. So it is a huge issue for us. It's one that I pay attention to every day. Every working day that I'm here, I get updated on traffic crashes and fatalities. So to your question, is a significant concern for us, sir. Could not tell you right now what the funding levels are, but we can certainly get back to you with that.
Leading about me.
Thank you, Chair. That'll do it. I see Representative Whitty's got a question.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. My question is for Commissioner Jacobson. The telecommunications service bill 3966, are you concerned at all that money being taken out of it, I think the account's about $42 million, are you concerned that a lot of the expenses for that are big ticket expenses, like when councils go down and stuff like that, on funding this? And then what burden is this going to put on the smaller agencies? It probably works in Hennepin and Ramsey, but what about Yellow Medicine, where part-time correction officers are going into dispatch and now you're training them and taking away times from the jails and other places?
Commissioner James.
Thank you, Chair, and Representative Whitty. I think when it comes to funding for 911 dispatch centers, that's not necessarily my area of expertise right now. We do have an assistant commissioner here who spends some more time working through that issue that might be able to address that question as well, if that would be helpful.
Would you mind, Representative Whitty, repeating the question, and then we'll have the assistant commissioner himself and answer that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Assistant Commissioner. So my question is, the telecommunication training is coming out of a fund, $42 million. A lot of that is used for big ticket items. Are you concerned about the items? You know, if something goes down, you need to pay for these items. Is that going to put an impact on that fund, but also the burden that it's going to put on our smaller agencies, where sometimes they're part-time working in the corrections agency, but then they're in the dispatch center, and it could be, for smaller departments, that could be a huge drain on staff time.
Again, welcome. Please introduce yourself and answer that question.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, members of the committee. My name is John Cunningham, Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety, and I'm also serving as the Interim Director for Emergency Communication Networks, which is our program for the 911 system. So specific to the question, we've looked at the fiscal impact. We don't anticipate this to be a negative impact on the account. We do have funds available to cover that. We recognize that there are incredible needs in the PSAP community. As part of that, ECN is actually undergoing a complete statewide needs analysis to see what that next-gen 911 transition and some of the other needs that are there. But with the fiscal note that's attached to this, we're confident that we can cover that currently and then ongoing. And that is an eligible expense of the 911 fund. Specific to the next question, as part of the language that's been drafted, it does allow for compensation for training and credentialing and certification, so we can cover those costs associated with that training. And as part of standing up this new board, is certainly the community and stakeholder engagement will be vital to that as those standards are developed, recognizing that we do have many small PSAP centers that are serving our community. So to be cognizant of what works, you know, and is most appropriate for those PSAPs that may be doing multiple tasks and managing multiple operations at once.
Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mullen, and thank you, Assistant Commissioner. My other question, I asked it in committee, and I haven't got a response from anybody, so I know I didn't ask you this, but who is going to handle the complaints against public safety telecommunication? Is it the board? And because obviously we're training them, and if the training doesn't, if they fail at the training or something, where does that complaint go, and does that affect their licensing in this process?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Mueller, members of the committee, the way that the bill is drafted right now is there will be an independent board that would be stood up. The Department of Public Safety would assist with getting that board created and stood up with the stakeholders to be members of that board. As part of creation, that they would be responsible for rulemaking as well, so I would anticipate the administrative rule process to go down all those avenues to make sure that, one, the standards are set by the applicable rules, but then also any of the discipline or investigations that would come out of that as well should be part of that rulemaking process.
Representative Whitty.
So that would come through the board. The board would do the investigation and handle any of the complaints. Would that affect their license or any part of their job?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Mueller, members of the committee, I would need to circle back with our council to see exactly how that would potentially play out and whether or not there's ramifications within the current standard, but I don't know if I have enough info at this point to comment on that.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and this is my last question, so I appreciate that, because obviously I think training is important. We need more training, and I get worried about the burden that we can put on some smaller departments, but then what are the unintended consequences or consequences to that at the end? And then I know the one thing we've talked about is making sure our stakeholders, that we're working with our stakeholders and all that. And I guess my last question is, have you reached out to the sheriffs and do we have a letter of support from the sheriffs? Because obviously this is impacting their area. And are they giving you the thumbs up on this or what are their thoughts so we know they control most of our PSAPs. Thank you.
Yep, and I'll let you answer that. I will note that this was a member bill, not an agency bill. So as far as responsibilities for talking to stakeholders, but go ahead, Assistant Commissioner.
Chair Mueller, members of the committee, you are correct. This was not a DPS bill, so we did not do any direct outreach, you know, on this bill. We have anecdotally just received information that the sheriff's was neutral on this bill as they were waiting for additional information that was just relayed at the conference that I was attending. When their executive director relayed that information.
All right, any other questions for, yep, Representative Hewitt.
Chair, if you could give me some latitude on this, the commissioner brought something into this that I just wanna make sure of here, it's important to what's going on with us in the state and EMS right now. Commissioner, you said that deaths are up, and I know Representative Whitty talked a little bit about the DUIs and stuff like that, but I'm more concerned about, are we seeing these deaths in rural areas where we're starting to come to identify EMS deserts? Have there been any research? Are we gonna see reports on this? What are you finding? I'm curious, because we're actually actively doing something right now.
Commissioner Jacobson.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee, and that's a great question. The fatalities are all around the state of Minnesota, certainly a number of them on rural and certainly a number of them that are in the metro areas. I don't have any information right now that would indicate that those deaths are due to a slow or lack of response from EMS providers around the state of Minnesota. One of the things that we're working through with the Office of Traffic Safety is to get a more in-depth analysis of traffic fatalities ongoing, actually looking at using some additional tools to be able to better prepare our first responders and our police officers, law enforcement, on how to respond and where to respond to traffic fatalities and traffic issues. So I hope that in the next few months that we'll have some better data to overlay with where the traffic fatalities are, how to better respond, and then to be able to respond more quickly once those tools are readily available. But certainly, you know, if it, you know, takes much longer for first responder, emergency medical provider to respond to a traffic crash, you know, certainly that could have an impact on the health and well-being of a patient, a victim in a crash. But I do not have any data to say that that's been an issue right now, sir.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You had stated that this wasn't an agency bill, so I'm not sure if Commissioner Schnell, is he still around, is available. Oh, thank you, sir. To address this or able to address it, but in line 1714, it appears as though we are eliminating the salary cap on, what's this position? The executive director of the Cannabis Expungement Board. And the it references a section of law that places a cap on that at 120% of the governor's salary. I'm just wondering what the rationale for that is, and, you know, given the overall constraints that your department's been operating under financially, if we need to worry about how much money is going to go in that direction.
All right, thanks. And first, I'll just clarify what I meant wasn't an agency bill, was specifically the 911 telecommunicators bill. There are portions of this that are agency bills, but that was what I was referencing. And I think Mr. Johnson can answer that question. Mr. Johnson.
Madam Chair, Representative Hudson, this section 15A.0815 was repealed last session. And so you're going to see this probably in some other bills where there are references throughout statute. Not all the conforming changes were made last year. It's being stricken wherever it appears. The state government bill, and I'm afraid I don't have the citation, but they replaced this with a new provision that addresses salaries. It's somewhere else in law. I'd have to follow up to find that for you. The commissioner, of course, may have more additional comments.
Yeah, Commissioner Schnell.
Madam Chair, no, I would defer. This was more technical than anything we had to do.
Representative Hudson.
I very much appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to nonpartisan research.
All right. Any other questions for the commissioners? I think we will move on now to further testimony. We have Marsha Milliken here with the Minnesota Children's Alliance on behalf of the Crime Victim Coalitions. And then as you're making your way down, was there any other member of the public who wishes to testify on this bill? All right, I'm not seeing it, so saving the best for last, I guess. No offense to our commissioners. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
My name is Marsha Milliken. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Children's Alliance, and I'm speaking on behalf of all six coalitions serving victims of crime in our state. Thank you, Chair Mohler, and members of the House Public Committee for this opportunity, Public Safety Committee. These coalitions are the Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, Mending the Sacred Hoop Coalition, the Minnesota Alliance of Crime on Crime, Violence Free Minnesota, and the Minnesota Children's Alliance. Together, we advocate on behalf of organizations across the state serving victims of sexual and domestic violence, child abuse, and violent crime, as well as their families. Today, I'm testifying in support of the Public Safety Omnibus Bill that will allocate nearly $10 million in one-time funds for crime victim service organizations. Our coalitions would like to thank Chair Mohler and the Public Safety Committee, as well as the Governor's Office, for their commitment to meeting the needs of crime victims across Minnesota. This is particularly critical at a time when we are seeing federal funding cuts at 42%. While the six anti-violence coalitions will continue to advocate for our requested increase of $20 million annually, we recognize that the committee has invested significant time, energy, and funding into victim services during this legislative session, recognizing that we are at a crisis point that cannot wait until the next biennium. We look forward to continuing to work together to make this critical funding a reality and support crime victims across Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Now we will move on to the amendments. We've got the secondary amendments, and we will begin with, well, first I should ask, anybody have any questions for Ms. Milliken? All right. Thank you. Thank you again for your testimony. We'll move first to the A6 amendment. This is my amendment. It simply adds the word registration, which was missing from the Motor Vehicle Registration Compliance Working Group. Thank you to those eagle eyes that pointed that out to me. Any discussion to the A6 amendment? Okay, I will move the A6 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, the motion prevails and the A6 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A3 amendment. Who will be offering the A3 amendment? Representative Whitty.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Members, the A3 amendment deletes but not limited to the bill adds training, certification, and continuing education for public safety telecommunicators. The 911 special revenue account funded by fees on everyone's phone bill is used to fund the training, certification, and continuing education of public safety telecommunicators. The language is added to the existing statutory governing the use of 911 fees. However, the language states the Commissioner of Public Safety may use 911 fund to provide financial assistance to counties for the improvement of local emergency telecommunication services, included but not limited to public safety telecommunicator training, certification, and continuing education. I understand the need to use the phrase not limited to in some statutes, such as the circumstance that a judge may give an aggravated or mitigated sentence. Statutes can be contemplated every scenario, or statutes cannot contemplate every scenario a judge may use to depart from sentencing guidelines. But when it comes to the appropriation of taxpayer dollars, statutes must be explicit on what is allowed. So the A3 amendment removes the words but not limited to from the language authorizing the use of 911 special refund funding. Thank you.
All right, and I spoke with the author of this bill, this amendment, and we considered it a friendly amendment. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? All right, so Representative Whitty moves the A3 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A3 amendment is adopted. Next, we have the A2 amendment. Who will be offering the A2 amendment?
Chair Mueller, that's me.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller and members. As we heard from the testimony of the commissioners about how important it was for this appropriate for the money to be for OJP. Sorry, let me just get myself together again. My in between writing notes and doing all this stuff. We had heard from the commissioners how important it is that we have changed how much OJP is allowed to keep when they are doing administering of these grants, and that it does say, unless amounts of otherwise appropriated for administrative costs, a state agency may retain up to 5% of the amount appropriated to the agency for grants enacted by the legislature, and formula grants up to 10%. The youth intervention programs received over $7 million in last year's public safety omnibus bill. And OJP is currently allowed to keep up to 2% or 2.5% of the biennial appropriation for administration of the of these grants. The change in the bill says they are allowed to keep up to 10% now. And this actually quadruples what the, they were able to take from 141 to more than $700,000. These grants are supposed to be going to our youth, to our children, to our communities, so that they're able to be working in our communities. And so I would ask for a compromise of changing from either instead of 2% to 10% to compromise at 5%. This should be sufficient amount of funds to administer the costs of the youth intervention grants and would allow more money to go to our programs where they are desperately needed.
Thank you. And while I appreciate that, I am going to recommend a no vote on that amendment for multiple reasons. As we heard from Kate Weeks from OJP when they testified on the need for this, they explained to us that 2% currently doesn't even cover their cost to administer the grants. We've also had a lot of discussion in recent years about nonprofits receiving state funding and oversight that's needed. We had an OLA report, and so as part of that oversight, that costs money. It costs money to make sure that recipients of grants are complying with all the different requirements. And so that is one reason why we need to increase the amount. Additionally, it's my understanding that this will put this particular oversight in line with other grants that are being administered by the state with the same number. And I'll just note again that it is up to 10%. So hopefully it won't be at 10%, but it allows them to use what they need to in order to make sure that the recipients of the grants, particularly nonprofits, are complying with all the various requirements. And I think, you know, it's a fair change to make now, and we can take a look as it's implemented and make sure that the organizations that we want to make sure are receiving those funding are getting the funds that they deserve. So for that reason, all of those reasons, I'm going to recommend a no vote. Further discussion?
Sure.
Yep, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair. And I too am in favor of what you did with the bill for the simple fact that looking more into grants, Representative Mueller, and dealing with some pretty bad situations with the EMS thing and stuff like this, we don't only expect them to divvy up the grant, we expect them to manage the grant and make sure that and these are agencies beyond ambulance services, regional EMS programs, fire programs, things like that, that in, like the chair said, there is an audit out there that we're looking at really closely right now that, you know, we want them to be responsible for what they gave and make sure that it's actually functioning and get back to us on it. So I think this is very reasonable for us to make sure that there is some sort of regulator over those grants. It's the state money. It's not our money. It's the state's money. So I think this is so important with what I'm running into right now.
We'll go to you to closing comments. Any further discussion, though, on it? Any other members? All right, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, for your comments and discussion. I guess, you know, we as a state have, by having a robust grant program, we've created this problem in that sense. I mean, we have made it so that instead of, looking at some other type of way to administer out money, we have created this grant oversight necessity. I don't know of a single agency where you have said up to, where they haven't gone up to. And also to go back and say, oh, well, we'll go back later and see if we don't need it, then maybe we can claw it back later. I don't know a government that has ever done that. They don't go backwards. Once you've given them money, they don't go backwards. And that doesn't mean that they don't have that doesn't mean that we don't look at it and say that, hey, let's look at it. It also doesn't mean that we don't expect them to manage the grants and that we don't manage, we want them to do oversight. All of those things can be true at the same time. I'm saying that when you look at the percentage of money that we're increasing, obviously 2% wasn't enough. 10% I believe is excessive. 5% is a good compromise, and that we're able to be able to say, listen, we need to be able to have, especially since we've created dependency on grants, that this money should be going to our communities. So thank you for your comments, and thank you, Representative Hewitt, as you're continuing to uncover this. I think that is important for us to remember that that sometimes we have to be the adults in the room to say, hey, this is what has to happen. So thank you, Chair Mueller. I would encourage people to support the amendment.
Representative Mueller moves the A2 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The A2 amendment is not adopted. Next, we have the A1 amendment. Who will be offering the A1 amendment? Lead Novotny.
Thank you, Chair. First of all, I'd like to say that I appreciate that the Chair eliminated the language that was in the previous bill or the previous form of the bill when we first heard this in committee. When we talked about the
racial makeup of the administrators of the programs. So thank you for responding to that language request that I had. When we look at the new bill, the DE1, there's still specific targeting language that I don't understand. We've had the testimony from different people here familiar with working with my organizations that the funding is across the board. The 41% federal credit cut is across the board throughout the state. And hopefully I can short circuit some of the discussion that we had last time. I'll reiterate the fact that I originally said we had a number of $20 million increase. I said we needed 40, and that was just a napkin guess off the top of my head, and turns out that was pretty close at that 40. We probably need more than that now. Take nothing away. I absolutely value the services that these victim services provide. They are a vital part of the system. They do great work helping the victims from the start to finish. I just don't understand. I read the letter that's been submitted. Nowhere do I see where it says funding should go to targeted individuals. It's a statewide problem. My question is, are we truly one Minnesota or are we not? Are all victims equal or are some victims more equal than others? Doesn't matter where you are in the state. I have the confidence that whenever someone calls for help from one of these centers or advocacy groups, that whoever calls or walks in the door is going to get the help they can. My amendment does nothing to change the program. Does nothing to change the current amount of funding that we have, although if it was up to me, I'd radically increase it. It just strikes some language that targets it seemingly to a specific area of the state when everyone in the state is suffering. That is my amendment, Chair Mullen.
Thank you. I'm going to recommend a no vote, and I just want to read the sentence out loud that you're wanting to strike here. It is that services funded must include services for victims of crime in underserved communities most impacted by violence and reflect the ethnic, racial, economic, cultural, and geographic diversity of the state. The language in the bill actually makes sure that the money can go out to all the different programs and communities throughout the state. It says must include. I think if we were to strike this language, you could actually, OJP could decide to give all that money to programs just in Minneapolis or just in one city. I think having this language in here makes it clear that we can, that they need to be looking inclusively at all of those different things, ethnic, racial, economic, cultural, and geographic diversity of the state. So I think that this language is very important. As you mentioned, we took out the one sentence that I think caused the most discussion probably when we last heard the bill. I also just want to point out that line 2.25, we limited the language here to those organizations that received a grant in fiscal year 2024. There may be new programs out here that need to be started to cover needs. There probably are, but because this is just a Band-Aid and this is such a big funding problem, we wanted to make sure that we were limiting these funds to programs currently in existence. So just wanted to point out that that's that change, and I think that change is important in light of the language in the bill that I think should remain in the bill. Discussion? Chair Beckerfin.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, and I wanted to thank you for including this language, and I think it does reflect what we should all want to do, which is to make sure that the funding is going out equitably. And I think I honestly don't understand why someone would have a problem with this language. I don't think, I also think it's important for communities to see that we're acknowledging that historically maybe some groups have been funded better than others, or some areas of the state might have more resources to give than, you know, I think of folks who live in the far northeastern corner of the state might not have the resources or access to the funding sources and things from the community. And so I think that it's entirely appropriate and good that we include this, because it both acknowledges the discrepancies in some communities being underserved, but also directs that it go to reflect the diversity across the state. And I think sometimes it seems like there's confusion about what diversity means, and it could mean you, and it could mean me. It doesn't just mean communities of color. It doesn't just mean groups that speak one language or another. I mean, it's all of those things. It's sort of it's confusing to me that this would be upsetting or problematic to anyone when it's stated so clearly. And also it says must include. It doesn't say must be limited to any one group. It says must include the full diversity of our state. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing. And thank you, Chair Mueller, for updating this language.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll add to that, but I won't repeat everything, but Chair Breckenridge, I think you did a good job encapsulating the reason this language is important in this bill. You know, we've got issues all over the state. We've got particular ethnic, racial groups that cover and live all over the state of Minnesota. That's why this language is important. We want to make sure that those resources are touching every part of the state that needs those resources. I agree. If we don't have language that ensures that these resources will be going out equally and equitably, it may not happen. Chair Rebecca Finn mentioned that some places may have been underfunded. We know for a fact that places and communities geographically and racially have been underfunded in our state for decades. We're trying to address those issues to make this truly a one Minnesota and a better Minnesota for all. Thank you, Chair.
Further discussion? Lead Novotny.
Is the OJP administrator still here?
Yes, I do see her here. Normally don't call, but because it's agency, we'll go ahead and bring her down.
It'll be short.
Yep, do you want to ask your question as she's making her way down?
Yes, thank you, Chair. The question would be, when you're administering your OJP grants throughout the state, do you feel that you're fair and equal in how you handle out these grants? And do you feel without specific language included, specifically line 3.7 to 3.10, without that guiding language, would you be able to fairly and equitably disperse these funds?
Please introduce yourself and answer that question.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kate Weeks. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Justice Programs with the Department of Public Safety. Our current practice at OJP is we really do lean into looking at all of the applications and to ensure that services are available throughout the state, because as you noted, crime occurs throughout the state and there is great, great need across the state. And thank you to the committee for making further investments in that area. I will say that is what we do now. I think in the past, as you've heard testimony before, that may not have been the case. I can assure you as the executive director right now, that is what we do. But I can't speak for who comes behind me or who comes next, and that they maintain those priorities. And so, but as we do now, that is our goal and that is our mission, to make sure that that money goes far and wide and serves as many people as we can.
Thank you. Yep. Sure.
And I'll just ask, or I'll just note too, that this language that we're talking about is in past bills and past legislation. Is that correct, Director Weeks?
Chair, committee, yes, some version of this language has been included in previous bills directing funding and directing how OJP distributes those grants.
Lead Novotny.
Thank you. And when you get a chance, it's not a question, it's just a request from you. When you get a chance, could you forward me these grants that you feel have been disparately administered throughout the state in the past? I'm not familiar with the claims that just talked about, so if you could forward me what you're talking about where there's been disparate funding in the state, I'd like to know about that. Going back, I don't know, a decade, please.
Director Weeks.
Yeah, Chair Committee, I'm happy to share the funding decisions and the grantees for the past 10 years. If there's additional information you need, we absolutely can provide that. I know funding has been very volatile over the years, whether it be state or federal funds, so you're going to see those increases and decreases, increases in services, decreases in services. So I'm happy to share that. The current list of grantees is on our website right now, and I can share that with the committee administrator as well to share or to share out to the committee so you can kind of see where that is being dispersed currently as well.
Lee Novotny.
Well, if you could just point to the ones in that. You do thousands of dollars or grants, and it's a very thing. If there's been the allegation that there's been disparate funding, I'd like to know what those are on the specific cases, and we don't need to do that now. We can do this offline.
Anything further, Lee Novotny, to your amendment?
No, thank you.
Representative.
Oh, well, to the amendment or to Ms. Hobbs?
To the amendment.
To the amendment. I guess I have more faith in the OJP. I want to clarify a couple things. I'm not upset about this language. I just think the language is unnecessary. I think the OJP does a good job. I trust them to do it fairly. I don't know why we need to target it. That's it. Thank you, Chair. And I request a roll call.
All right. Representative Novotny has requested a roll call. Representative Novotny moves the A1 amendment to the DE1 amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mueller.
No.
Chair Mueller votes no. Vice Chair Feist.
No.
Vice Chair Feist votes no. Lee Novotny.
Aye.
Lee Novotny votes aye. Representative Becker Finn.
No.
Representative Becker Finn votes no. Representative Curran.
No.
Representative Curran votes no. Representative Frazier.
No.
Representative Frazier votes no. Representative Grossel.
Aye.
Representative Grossel votes aye. Representative Hollins.
No.
Representative Hollins votes no. Representative Hudson.
Aye.
Representative Hudson votes aye. Representative Hewitt.
No.
Representative Hewitt votes no. Representative Mueller.
Mueller votes yes.
Representative Mueller votes yes. Representative Pinto.
No.
Representative Pinto votes no. Representative Tapke.
No.
Representative Tapke votes no. Representative Witte.
Aye.
Representative Witte votes aye.
There being five ayes and nine nays, the motion does not prevail. Next, we have the A5 amendment. Who will be moving the A5? Representative Hudson, to your A5.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. The A5, or Madam Chair.
Okay, I did have a pro temp speaker this week briefly, so it's okay. Go ahead.
And doing a good job of it, if I might add.
Thanks.
So what the A5 does is it takes the appropriation for the Motor Vehicle Compliance Working Group and it shifts it over to the Crime Victim Services appropriation and eliminates that Motor Vehicle Compliance Working Group. And, you know, perhaps in discussion over this amendment we'll get into more whys and wherefores, but basically the point that I'll start with here is that we've raised the issue of the financial burden placed upon these victim services group, the reduction in federal funding. And I also think, like, the purpose of this motor vehicle compliance working group is to examine how and why we would stop traffic stops or end traffic stops in order to get payment for renewal of license tabs. And I don't know that we need a working group in order to do that, because we've seen jurisdictions where this experiment has already been initiated. Minneapolis is an example, as I understand it, Berkeley, California, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And the data is still being collected and analyzed regarding the effectiveness of this policy. And so rather than spend
$133,000 of our money to figure out whether and how it works. Maybe we can just take a little time, watch these other jurisdictions, let it play out, and see if we can glean lessons from that. And in the meantime, we can provide some extra funding to our crime victim survivors. So that is my amendment, and I would urge a yes vote.
All right, Representative Frazier.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Representative Hudson, the chair laid out pretty good synopsis of what's been happening over the at least the interim and the last few years. We've been trying to convene the stakeholders in this area to ensure that we do this the right way, so that we don't have any growing pains when we implement the idea of taking law enforcement out of the taking them out of the process of collecting due taxes, for lack of a better way to say it. We've met with these groups. We do need to bring them together. They do need to communicate face-to-face to come up with some recommendations for this. And these are the issues that they raise. These are things that they raise concerns about. I also think it's going to be beneficial because we have issues right now. Even when folks are pulled over and given a citation, they still have to pay that citation. And there still can be holdups in terms of getting them to pay that citation. So figuring out a way now on the front end before we implement anything in terms of removing law enforcement from making these stops to pay taxes, I think it's the better route to go. And I think the quicker we do it, the better it'll be for our drivers out there. And also in terms of making sure we have ways, recommendations that we can implement to make sure that we collect these fees. So I urge a no vote.
And I'll just note, too, that Representative Hudson, you mentioned some other jurisdictions doing this, including other states. And one of the things that Rep. Frazier and I discovered when we were talking about this bill, overall bill, and that DE that we didn't end up adopting was other states have a system where people keep their license plate when they sell their cars instead of what we do now. And that was potentially one of the recommendations. But there are a lot of other different ways to do it. And so when we were talking through some of these issues and, you know, it was brought to our attention, like deputy registrars are impacted by these things. And it was more than just something that, like, DVS could make a decision on how to deal with it. And if you look at the membership of this, there are a lot of different members. Again, it's a lot of stakeholder engagement to do as individual bill authors. And so that's why having that discussion, you know, hopefully we can move forward with a law that will eliminate traffic stops for unpaid fines. But whether that happens or not, just having these groups together to talk about a new and better way for making sure that we're collecting that revenue, I think is important. Other discussions to the amendment? Lead Novotny.
My question would be for the author of the particular section or for the chair, what is the goal of eliminating the traffic stops?
Sure, I can address that. I mean, you know, I think when we talked about the overall bill that Representative Frazier had, and particularly that amendment, again, that we were unable to do the work on during the committee, during the short period of time we have, the overall goal is to really focus on traffic stops that are important to public safety. And so I think that there is agreement that it is not related to public safety whether or not someone has paid their registration fee on for their car. That's the overall goal of the bill. And there are other things that we were looking at, too, that seem unrelated to public safety, like having an air freshener or having a small crack even in your windshield. All of the things that allow law enforcement now to pull people over really result in disparate impacts in our communities. And so that was the overall goal of the bill. Obviously, it's very much, you know, we're not hearing that part of the bill now. But that's the overall goal of the bill, and that's why we would want to eventually eliminate non-public safety stops like those related to paying taxes on your cars. Lead Novotny.
Chair Mueller, the one thing I will tell you over time is I'm old enough to remember when you didn't have to have no-fault insurance in the state. One of the biggest predictors of someone not having current insurance on their vehicle is not having tabs. If you look at the big picture, it's this long slide, lowering the bar. Don't stop for this. Don't stop for that. And what does it lead to? It leads to traffic deaths rising sharply. To me, Section 5 is just another case of things that we're doing that are unnecessary, and it's money that could well be used somewhere else. I would much rather see this money spent on something where it'll make a difference in people's lives, like the victim service advocates that we all agree is important. Thank you, Chair.
Further discussion. Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Biden, to your point about the indicator of insurance, I mean, when you renew your tabs now, you have to show proof of insurance, so that will still be covered. When you renew your tabs, they will still be requesting to show proof of insurance, so that issue would be addressed. And just a further point, I mean, you talked about putting this money somewhere is more important. This is an important issue. We're talking about finding ways to mitigate some of the problematic interactions we've had with traffic stops. And if you would like to see data on disparity there, we can get you that data. And for those particular reasons, I'd still urge a no vote on this amendment.
Okay. Any further remarks? Leading about me. Closing remarks.
Chair Mueller, I'll close with this. I'll save it for the floor. It's the long slide. I've stopped thousands of cars for not having current tabs, or we'll get to the other thing, the equipment violations, and not a one of them ended up in the situation that you think we can avoid by just lowering the bar. And we'll talk about it on the floor. Thank you, Chair.
Yep. And my apologies, I forgot that it was Representative Hudson that was offering the amendment, and you're waiting patiently over there for your closing remarks. Representative Hudson.
Yeah, you got two closing remarks for the price of one.
You asked.
We got a little bit of time, so I want to try to unpack. I mean, you brought up disparities, Representative Frazier.
I did.
Because what this seems to be doing is putting together a working group to reinvent the wheel. Let's figure out a different way to do what we're already doing that's working just fine. And what I'm hearing is that, well, it's not working fine because we're not able to get compliance or deal with people who don't comply, but because there are disparate impacts from traffic stops that escalate into something more, sometimes something deadly. And I think when you dig into the details of what those stops, how those stops go and what they're like, I seriously doubt you could find an example of an officer escalating for no reason, like just none, just out of the blue. The reason why things escalate is lack of compliance, lack of following lawful orders, escalation on the part of the driver, the person who's being pulled over. And the officer has to maintain order and enforce the law. I mean, that's their responsibility. That's a duty that they have. They have to do that. And it seems as though what we're saying is, well, let's have less situations where the officer has a duty to enforce the law, and that's somehow going to solve the problem. Disparities impacted my opinion on a totally different bill that's outside the jurisdiction of this committee, and if you'll indulge me, the African American Family Preservation Act that we've talked about. When I've sat and I've listened to the data that's been presented and considered the disparities in child protective services and the way that black families are treated, that speaks to me and that moves me, because what's happening there is things that shouldn't be enforced, things that shouldn't be happening, kids being removed unjustly from their families, are happening. And they're happening at a disproportionate rate to black families. When you come over to the public safety side and these traffic stops, and I know we have differences of opinion on this, but I don't see things happening in these stops that aren't supposed to be happening. If somebody is found to be guilty of some other crime as a result of having been pulled over for their license tabs being expired, they properly ought to be dealt with under the law according to the training and duties of that officer. That's something that should happen. And if the situation escalates for lack of compliance in that situation, that's the fault of and responsibility of the person who's been pulled over. To compare it to the Child Protective Services situation, none of us would say, and we've had these conversations, none of us would say that if we found a child who is in imminent threat of danger because of the way that they were being treated in their house, whatever that situation was, that we would just leave them there because they're black. We wouldn't do that. And we've had that conversation. And so the principle there is that if it's appropriate for government to take action, it should take action. And to the extent that inappropriate things are happening disproportionately to people, then we should work to stop that. And that's kind of where I'm coming from with this, is I see this as an effort to reinvent the wheel to achieve something that's already being well achieved for a reason that, in my judgment, doesn't have a whole lot of merit. So I would continue to urge a yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hudson moves the A5 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The A5 amendment is not adopted. Next, we have the A4 amendment. Who will be offering the A4?
That'd be me, Chair.
Lee Novotny.
Chair Mueller, the A4 amendment refers to the part of the bill, line 8, that includes a requirement that when a peace officer makes a traffic stop, the officer must inform the vehicle's operator of the reason for the stop before the question. I take words seriously, and I think must means must, and I see nothing but a quagmire and that is going to drag people down and have another opportunity for the lawyers to go after the officers out there doing true public safety work. There are many instances that I can think of where the peace officer would not have a chance to get to tell the driver the reason for the stop. Could be the actions by the driver, could be actions by the passengers. It could be other information that is gathered before the stop is initiated and before the first contact with the operator is made. Maybe they get told by dispatch as they're walking up to the car that the car is stolen, or that the person has a restraining order against them, or the person has an active pickup order on them, as we have seen recently. There could be other factors that are outside of the control of both the officer and the driver. It could be traffic safety issues. It could be bystanders. All these things could come into play. My amendment, if adopted, would give exceptions, because I think given the tone of things, this is going to, you won't strike it, but at least we can modify it to give some guidelines. For example, if one of the passengers or operators acts in a way that prohibits the officers from informing them of the reason for the stop, or there's a reasonable, objectable officer would believe based on the totality of the circumstances known to the officer at the time and without benefit of hindsight that the vehicle's operator or passenger is engaged in criminal conduct other than the conduct formed in the basis of the traffic stop or recently engaged in such contact or conduct, I'm sorry. I think there's got to be some language that allows for this to adjust in these rapidly evolving, potentially dangerous situations so that, A, the officers aren't put at risk by suffering sanctions because they didn't tell the operator why they were stopped before something happened, or they're precluded from doing that from circumstances beyond their control. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Votney, are we going to have a long debate on the floor?
We don't have to.
Well, I'm going to urge a no vote, so I think we are. You know, Representative Novotny, I think you're looking for, you're offering exceptions to a proposed law that already has baked in those exceptions. This is specific to 168 and 169 violations when the officer pulls them over. So if it's a 168 or 169 violation, that is when this language would apply. You're pulling someone over for a broken taillight or they didn't stop at a stop sign. Pull them over, stops you because you didn't stop at a stop sign. You rode through that stop sign. License registration, I'll be right back. You have a broken taillight, here's your voucher. License registration, I'll be right back. I think this is low-hanging fruit for a ways to build toward having better relations between law enforcement and community groups. This is not at all an attempt to put officers in harm's way. There's nothing attached to this to say would preclude officers from following a normal protocol or procedures if there is something that they observe or see that would be dangerous, where they would have to follow other training. All of that is accounted for already because, again, this is very narrow in terms of the statutes that are applied when they have to use the language. And I think, again, those exceptions are baked in because of how narrow this language is for the two areas of the law that it would require the officers to provide that information as to why you've been stopped for that traffic violation.
Chair Pinto.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. As I'm looking at the language that's in the bill, I guess, Lee Novotny, I'm trying to figure out, I mean, if looking at your amendment, I'm trying to figure out situations where your amendment would apply and yet the officer is interested in engaging in questioning related to suspected traffic violation. As Representative Frazier said, this is really narrowly drafted, that you can't engage in questioning related to the violation until you've informed the operator the reason for the stop. If the vehicle operator is inhibiting the officer's ability to inform the operator the reason for the stop, well, I'm kind of thinking you got a bigger problem than engaging in questioning about the traffic violation, right? And so now we kind of move on to something else. So, and this is really narrowly drafted. I would agree that the amendment brings in all kinds of pieces that, with the narrow drafting of this language, are unnecessary and really problematic. So I would urge a no vote as well. Thanks.
Further discussion? Representative Woody.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. Thank you, Chair Frazier, for stepping off the floor last night and having a discussion about this. I can't tell you how many traffic stops I did in my career, and not one of them is a routine traffic stop. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of thoughts going through your head, and just because you might stop them for an equipment violation, they could have a warrant that you don't know because they're not the driver. They could be an armed robber that just committed a crime somewhere down the road, or they could just be, you know, having a bad day. My concern, and when we talked about it, was just the confusion or just the thought process that can be brought in. Do I have to tell them why I stopped here, why I didn't? The scenario you and I went through, and I think it made sense after we talked, was I stop you because I run the plate and the person has an active warrant. Well, I'm not going to walk up to that car and tell that person they have an active warrant because now they're going to think the worst case scenario. And if they have a weapon in the car, that could turn bad for the officer, but also if they present a weapon, it could turn bad for the person. So I think that's where the chaos starts to happen and things move pretty quickly. Or they decide, you know, I'm just going to drive away and I'm going to take off and now the pursuit's on and it takes out a family or a person or, you know, hurts themselves. So obviously when you explain the 169, 168, I understood that part. And so, you know, I appreciate you having that conversation because that was a scenario that was going through my head. There are reasons why we stop people that might not just be for the one reason. And the concern could be that could start the debate right at the window. Hey, I've been stopped before. You got to tell me why you're stopping me. And it's like trying to get them calm down so you can at least get them out and safely effect the arrest. So, and you talked about the reasonings also, so I appreciate that conversation. It was helpful.
Yeah, I appreciate you.
Yeah, and I think, right, to that point, you know, if that is an active warrant, we are not saying at all that you have to tell somebody that they have an active warrant. That is not what this language does, because it is so narrowly tailored to Chapter 168 and 169 violations and to questioning related to those violations. So those types of scenarios, we absolutely understand that there's a lot of fluid situations and would not require law enforcement to tell somebody right away that they had a warrant. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to ask a question, and I guess it's up to you as to whether or not it can be answered appropriately at this point in the debate. But so, I mean, if I'm understanding this correctly, it sounds like the language in 826 through 828 is so narrowly tailored that an officer could argue that if they never ask a question related to the traffic stop, then they don't have to tell the person why they pulled them over.
I think that's fair. I think that's a fair reading of it. Yes.
That would be fair, but that goes
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be fair, but I would imagine in my conversations with officers and law enforcement association, when they engage, they do want to have conversations with those individuals. And I would think it would be odd, because I remember during the committee hearing that one of the things that you stated was that this is how many of the engagements happen with citizens, is that officers have these traffic stops. Now, I would argue that those are probably not delightful engagements. I don't like to get stopped. It could ruin my day if I'm running late or I need to be somewhere. But in many cases, there are conversations to be had. So I would find it strange in situations that we started to see a trend where the officers pulling someone over, getting to the window, and not saying anything.
No. Representative Hudson.
Allow me to clarify. Thank you, Madam Chair. what I'm suggesting is,
what am I thinking?
That the language says that they must inform the vehicle operator of a reason for the stop before engaging in questioning related to a suspected traffic violation. One could argue that I can ask any question I want that's not related to a suspected traffic violation, because, as you're saying, this is so narrowly authored. So I'm confused as to what it is that you're trying to accomplish with this language, because actually kind of grateful, because it sounds like what you're saying is cops can keep doing what they've been doing. They just won't be able to say why they pulled somebody over, which seems odd to me.
Well, and I think one of the things I'll say is the practice of pulling someone over and saying, do you know why I stopped you? You're like putting someone in a position right away to say, I was speeding, have to admit guilt, or I don't really know why you stopped me. Maybe I have a broken brake light or tail light. And so maybe we need clarity around that. I certainly think we could, look at that. But I think that was sort of one of the practices that we were trying to get at, was that, like, putting the person on the spot and trying to ask them, do you know why I stopped? I really don't know why you stopped me. Representative Hudson.
Thank you. And I appreciate the flexibility to have a more free-flowing conversation on it, because if the objective is to ask questions about something specific rather than open-ended questions, then maybe this accomplishes that. I'm not sure, but I would take a look at it as it moves forward. Thank you.
All right. Final remarks? This was your amendment, right?
What was the last part?
It was your amendment, correct?
Yes, it was.
All right. Closing remarks on the amendment.
Representative Frazier touched on the fact that he talked to several law enforcement agencies. When did you talk to the big three, the MPPOA, the Sheriff's Association, and the Chiefs of Police? Because they did the letter that said they strongly oppose this. If we were going to do a task force on anything, I think this would have been the thing we could have done a task force on and at least address that. And we don't need to keep beating it up, but this is the basis, and the words are very specific. Representative Hudson touched on it. It's so specific, it's uncomfortable, and just doesn't make sense. I don't think it's going to achieve what you think it's going to achieve. I agree that this could be a very good community relations thing. I I'm the number two signer and was honored to be able to was asked by Representative Habke to sign on to his lights on bill that would give vouchers to get these equipment violations fixed. It is a great community relations if it's done and done fairly and properly. So don't take anything that I didn't say, but the law enforcement agencies, they're very concerned about this also. It's not just us or me. This is there. If we're going to do this, we need to do it better or at least clearer. That's all I have, Chair. Thank you.
Representative Novotny moves the A4 amendment to the DE1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The A4 amendment is not adopted. All right, members, it is noon, but we do have a little bit of extra time, and if we can finish today, it means we don't have to come back on Thursday. So let's go ahead and move to discussion of the underlying bill. First, I will move the DE1 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The DE1 amendment as amended is adopted. Any member discussion to the bill as amended? All right, not seeing any. And so I will renew the motion that House File 5216 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. All right, well, members, that was a great discussion. As always, really appreciate the thorough discussions that this committee has. It's been a really fun and rewarding experience for me to be the chair and to have just a great team of people to work with. Just also want to thank, again, both our nonpartisan and our partisan staff for all of your hard work helping this committee. We couldn't do this without you, including our pages, the reviser, the security, all the people who work behind the scenes to make this possible. I can't believe this is our last official meeting. And with that, we are adjourned.